Hey guys. How is everybody? Good. Whether you know it or not, you gave me this. And so thank you very much. I appreciate it. It is beautiful. I'm going to put it over here. I appreciate it. I'm kind of a short girl with short girl problems, so I'm assuming you can at least see a portion of me up here at the top. Okay, as a former educator, I came totally prepared. I have pages and pages of notes, which we may or may not get to. One of the things I like to do, I know we've already done it, but if we could, I would like to open my talk with a serenity prayer again, at least the first portion of it. So if we could just have a moment of silence. Okay, guys, can you join me? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. My name is Jamie, and my birthday in Al-Anon is July 14th, 2010, so that makes me relatively new in the program, just about 7.5 years. Our literature tells us that we are to share our story, tell about how we were, where we are today, and how we came to be where we are today. And so my story may or may not do that. This narrative that I have tonight may or may not do that. I texted with my sponsor earlier today, and she just gave me the most amazing words and little words in a prayer, and that was that while tonight you may hear my voice, that I hope you will hear God's words, that whatever is said tonight is what God meant for me to say and for you to hear, whatever that may be. I know for a fact one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to read different quotes that I like from the 12 and 12 and from the Big Book. This is my home group. Happy Destiny, one of the reasons that I love this meeting so much is because we do use the 12 and 12, and we do use the Big Book. Those two pieces of literature seem to be the ones that I go to the most. They're my go-to. They're what my sponsor brought me through the steps on, both my first and my second and current sponsor brought me through, and it's how I bring my sponsees through the steps. So I'm glad you guys are here, and I hope that these words ring as powerful and true to you as they do to me. The first quote I'm going to give you is one that is why I get up and stand here and do what I do. Page 124 of the Big Book. The painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problems. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that in God's hands the dark past is your greatest possession, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. I love that. I love that. A little bit about my background, I'll start there, is I was raised in a little southeast Texas town, not far from the Louisiana border. I was raised in a nice Southern Baptist stoic family. My dad was a young man who had grown up very poor in our hometown and actually, like, literally wore potato sacks, sewn potato sacks for shirts at times. His dad was very sick throughout his youth, He worked in the refineries, my grandfather did, and he had pancreatic cancer at a time when that no one survived that, and amazingly, my grandfather did. So my dad had two younger sisters. They were twins, actually, and it was just kind of a rough life. They grew up in a rural area, and it wasn't the best life to have at the time. So my dad had an out, and that was athletics. He was very gifted athletically, and he was able to acquire a scholarship. And so he went off to Tulane and became captain of the Tulane football team and just had a great time in New Orleans, and then was able to return home. He became a teacher at our local high school and was on the coaching staff, and then would eventually move on to become a successful business owner in our community. My mom was a beautiful brown-haired, brown-eyed debutante from New Orleans. She had gone to LSU, and my dad actually met her after the death of his first wife. My dad's first wife was my mom's best friend. So they met after that and were married, and then along came my brother and I. My brother first, and then I. My brother is very, very special to me. He was the golden child. He was the one who was always compliant and fit within the family structure and the family narrative. I did not. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But my brother is really special to me. My dad recently, about a year ago, matter of fact, almost a year ago, passed away. And that has brought a whole new set of issues to light. The 1 year anniversary of my dad's death, but I'm kind of chasing squirrels, so let me go back to my family narrative. I didn't fit the family narrative in that, first of all, I wasn't a boy, right? We're a good Southern Baptist family from a small Southeast Texas town, and I'm a girl. And there's, true or false, there was a very clear narrative in my family of how a woman showed up or how a girl or a lady showed up. And some of those things were, you were always nice, you were always polite, you were quiet, you were demure, you were submissive, and the list kind of goes on and on from there. The problem was when God created me and when he thought about putting me together, that was not the personality that he formed for me. My personality was not quiet. It was not demure. It was not a lot of the things that were expected in my family and in my community. There's a quote in here actually that I want to read to you guys because I think that it fits me so perfectly, and it comes from, of course, the Big Book. It says, and I'm going to substitute Al-Anon. So where I say Al-Anon is where it says alcoholic, but we Al-Anons are sensitive people. We are enthusiasts who run to extremes. And that certainly fits me. I had extremes, and I was enthusiastic about life, and I wanted to be loud, and I wanted to be happy, and I wanted to be happy, joyous, and free, and that didn't necessarily fit with how I was expected to behave. My family was a patriarchal family. My dad was very authoritarian and authoritative. And obviously that's going to be a clash for my personality, or it was, still can be a clash for my personality. And a couple things that I learned from my family of origin that have really impacted me. I'm going to talk about three things that really impacted me in my family of origin. First of all, I was taught, that I needed to be dependent on men. So I carried that with me into my teenage years and into my adulthood, to be dependent on men to meet my needs. That was equivalent to what a good woman did. There wasn't a lot of independence taught. The second thing is that I was not a good girl. I was not a good girl because I didn't measure up and I didn't fit in to the predetermined categories that were placed on me by my family. I had opinions and I had emotions, and so I wasn't a proper lady. I didn't mirror that debutante that my mom was, or that my dad, or that my faith community thought was appropriate. Another thing is, both my parents were educators and then would go on to pursue advanced degrees. So knowledge became a really important thing in my family. It was taught. Knowledge was power. The more you knew, the more power you had, or the more power that you could implement over other people, places, and things. And so I became a seeker of knowledge. And that was interesting whenever I came into the rooms of this program. Knowledge is important. It absolutely is. But I had to really, I had to step back from that and look at knowledge in a different way. You can know this program inside and out. You can memorize these steps and these traditions. You can memorize the Al-Anon ease talk. There's a lot of things that you can know. But my knowing, I think it even says that in the big book, my knowing gets me nowhere in this program. I don't know the exact quote, but it says something about knowledge and self-will does not get us through this program. So that's been my experience. Two subjects that were talked about a lot in my family, because Southern Baptist, and by the way, I'm not banging on Southern Baptist. It's just what I was. It's how I grew up. So if you're Southern Baptist, this is not meant for you. It's just my personal story. Where I grew up in my Southern Baptist community, two things that went hand in hand were religion and politics. They were like hand in glove. And we talked about religion and politics all the time at our table. You came to the table dressed, where there was always a proper dinner at night. You came to the table dressed, and no one got up until everyone was done. And there was always discussion going on at the kitchen table. And people tended to fall into two distinct categories, those who were right and those who were wrong. And those who were right believed the way that we believed. They had our same values. They had our same they had our same identity. And those who were wrong were those who did not look like us, who did not talk like us, who did not sound like us, who did not think like us. And so I was raised in a world of black and white. There's good, there's bad, there's in, there's out, there's right, there's wrong. And that, too, would be a real challenge for me in coming into this program and trying to learn to live life differently and to live life on life's terms. It would be very difficult for me. A third thing, so I think two things I've talked about is, first, I was taught that I needed to rely on men for my needs. Second, I was taught I was not a good girl. And then third, I was taught that I didn't know my truth. I couldn't speak my truth out loud. And any time I tried to present my truth and who I was, I was scolded, or I was shamed, or I was told that's not right, or that's not how we do things in this family. That's not the page that we're on. That's not what we believe in this family. I was the black sheep. I just did not fit into my family and my family narrative. And so one of one of the things that I found myself doing is, like in the big book, it says that we run to extremes, right? So in the big book, it says our extremes that we run to are selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, self-delusion, and on and on. And I kind of lived in that world. I didn't know that I did until I came into these rooms, but I didn't really know how selfish and self-centered I was when I had an inkling that I was selfish and self-centered, but to see, like, close up and face to face how selfish and self-centered I was a pretty rude awakening for me. There's a lot of things I would have labeled myself, but I don't know that I would have labeled myself some of the extremes that are listed in the big book that fit me so perfectly. Self-delusion. I had no idea I was living in a world of self-delusion, complete and total self-delusion about certain things. It was amazing to me. So although I was not raised in an alcoholic home, neither of my parents were alcoholics. We did have the behavior traits and the isms in our home. Neither of my parents are talking. My dad went to his grave assuring me that no one in our family was an alcoholic, and absolutely no one in our family was an alcoholic. How ridiculous. And my mom says, as far as she knows, there's no alcoholism on her side of the family. So I would say there is, but who knows? I didn't meet it face to face, but all the isms showed up in my family of origin. So definitely been impacted from that way. One of the things about being the black sheep of the family is that, in clinical terms, they say that the black sheep of the family, also known as the scapegoat, is the one who actually is feeling and absorbing and carrying everything that the family unit refuses to carry, acknowledge, or accept. So if you're familiar with the text, there's a text called the Bible, and it talks about a scapegoat and putting the sins onto the scapegoat and sending the goat out and having it be sacrificed for the benefit of a city or a community or a tribe. And that, in essence, is what a black sheep or a scapegoat is in a family member. We feel intuitively the truth of a family, but we're told all the time that our truth is not true. And I did that. So here again, it sets me up to be a perfect candidate for the rooms of Al-Anon. No wonder I intuitively take on the feelings of other people. I was bred to be that way. That's who I was. That's how I was raised to be. So, you know, in learning that, it was really no shock to find out that not only do I want to take on the feelings of my addicted loved one, but I want to take on the feelings of the person, of the mother in front of me that's checking out. I have no idea if she's a single mother or not, but I imagine everyone's a single mother because I was a single mother. And so I want to take on her feelings when her kid's acting up in the stroller or in the grocery cart in front of me. Or I want to take on the feelings of the waitress who I can tell is not having a good night. Or I just want to take on everybody's feelings and make everything all right for them. That's a drug for me. That's one of the ways that I get outside of myself, is I get in to other people, places, and things. If I can be of assistance to you, then I don't have to think about me. I don't have to look at me. I don't have to spend time on me. That's another thing that I find. I believe that my daughter and I, my daughter is, Shannon talked about my daughter in the beginning. My daughter is a heroin addict. She's an addict and an alcoholic. And I think for me, and again, since this is a program of take what you like and leave the rest, take what you like about this and leave the rest, I believe that my daughter and I are just two sides of the same coin. She's obsessed and she chases a needle and a drug, and I'm obsessed and I chase her. My obsession is as great as her obsession, and I go to the same lengths, and I take the same risk, and I engage in the same behavior as my daughter to get the drink or the drug. I do all that to get her to stop drinking and drugging. For example, I wrote some things down. My daughter consumes substances to alter the way she thinks and feels. Here are some things that I consume. I consume other people. I consume food. I consume shopping. I consume religion. I consume a whole host of things to try and alter the way I feel. It just isn't drugs or alcohol. And to me, there's just no difference. As long as I'm trying to chase something and put something in my path to change me, then I'm just as sick, and I'm searching for the same things that my daughter's searching for. I'm just searching for them in a different way. Does that make sense? So, in working and practicing the 12 steps, my sponsor has shown me, and I 100% believe this, it has changed me mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. The program doesn't just change the way I show up with my daughter. It changes the way I show up all the way around. It changes the way I am as a wife. It changes the way I am as a mother, as a friend, as a coworker. This program gets into every crevice and every part of my life, and slowly starts to make a difference. In the beginning, absolutely. The only difference it was making, actually, honestly, the only difference this program made in the very beginning, and my husband is here, he can attest to it, is it moved me from a fetal position, which was the only position I could assume, a fetal position in my bed, to an upright position in the car. As he drove me around town, I didn't expect to be upset. As he drove me around town from meeting to meeting, I didn't want to be in Al-Anon. And to be honest with you guys, thank you so much. I really didn't like y'all. I didn't like the stuff you said. I didn't like how you said it. I didn't like laughter. I was so offended that y'all were laughing in here because I really didn't know what there was to laugh about. I mean, my daughter, my only child, was ravaging herself and our family with the drink and the drug, and I would come in here and know that y'all have the same story as me, and y'all would be laughing. And I thought, oh God, forgive me. Self-righteous judgmentalism, the list goes on about my character defects, so I'm just going to put them out there for you. I'm just going to let you see them how they really look. I would come in here and think, oh, well, they obviously don't love their loved one the way I love my daughter because they would not be in here laughing. That's ridiculous. How disrespectful. And I would think crazy. I would just think crazy thoughts. And then people would invite me afterwards. There was one lady. She doesn't even go here anymore. Her name is Tony. I think her name was Tony. But after every meeting that I would attend that she was at, she would always ask me to go out. And I would refuse every time. Because I needed to get back home, to get in my bed, to get in the fetal position, to keep obsessing about my loved one. I couldn't go have a good time. I couldn't eat. She was always inviting me to go eat. And I'm like, eat? What are you talking about? I can't eat. I have things to think about. I have things to stress over. I've got to get back home into the dark quiet of my house and just obsess. I've come a long way thanks to sponsorship. Thanks to you guys and girls who sit in this program, who share your story, who are open and who are authentic and raw about what you say, who aren't afraid to kind of flash me with the not-so-nice portions of your life. who let me know that it's not just me. All of that stuff has been invaluable to me and helped me move through this program. I'm kind of chasing rabbit trails, and I got to tell you guys, the reason for that, maybe, I don't know, is this last week was absolutely hellacious. And so taking the time to just sit down and be still and trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to say tonight didn't really present itself because I was off busy in my disease, chasing a lot of different things, not getting on good spiritual ground and not having that good time to just sit and reflect. So as I told you guys in the beginning, when my sponsor said to me today, you're just going to be the voice and you're going to let God's words be the words. I'm really hoping that transpires tonight, even though there's no necessarily clear narrative. And even though I may be up and down and around the corner with my story, I hope that for your ears, God somehow sews it together so that it seems like a linear, continuative story, because it doesn't feel that way up here. But this is where I'm going. So, a couple of things that I really like in the big book that were important for me in the beginning. Page 33. If I plan on living the life ascribed by the Al-Anon steps, principles, and traditions, then I must have no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday I will be immune to the way I think, act, and respond. I am never going to be immune to the way I show up. I've already told you guys how, for better, for worse, for right, for wrong, I don't think my parents said, oh, let's think of all the ways we can jack up Jamie before we send her out into the world. I think it just, you know, it happens. So for better, for worse, my thinking, my best thinking did not get me when it came to the disease of alcoholism and addiction. It did not get me to a place of joy, of freedom, of serenity. I've already told you guys, it got me into the fetal position in a dark room. That's where it got me. And so, as I've already shared with you, these words mean a lot to me considering the last week of my life, because I've been resting on my laurels, and the big book tells us that we can't do that in this program. We have to always be vigilant, and we have to be aware, and we have to be working. And again, wisdom that my sponsor passes down to me is, Jamie, you're either moving forward or you're going back, but you're never standing still. You're never standing still, Jamie. So the decisions that you're making, are those moving you forward into a healthier place, or are those leading you backwards into the old behavior and the old patterns? And this past week, I think that I was moving backwards. I don't think. What are we talking about? This is a program of honesty. What am I talking about? I don't think anything. I know for a fact I was moving backwards at a pretty fast pace. Another thing from the big book, page 32 and 42. I can fall victim to thinking that long periods of emotional sobriety and self-discipline have qualified me to think and act like others. That's never going to happen. I'm not going to think like if there's even one that exists, I kind of think they're like unicorns, but if a normie exists, I'm never going to think and act like them, okay? I personally think normies are mystical creatures that ride on the backs of unicorns, but maybe they exist. Maybe y'all know them. I don't. Another thing says, I have learned that, here it is. Here's my quote. I have learned that willpower and self-knowledge do not and cannot help me in the strange mental blank spots. I am constantly coming into strange mental blank spots. You know, we read the gifts earlier, or the promises, and it talks about that we will intuitively know how to respond and think and behave in situations that used to baffle us. And that is true a lot of times, but I've been talking to my sponsor lately about a situation with my daughter. My daughter has been a guest of the state for about the last 9 months. She's been residing at the beautiful palace known as Lucille Plain State Jail in Dayton. She's currently in Galveston County, sitting out a little bench warrant, no biggie, about some other stuff that she's done. But she will be returned to her beautiful luxury accommodations at Plain State. And then on November 8th, she will be released. And so I have been resting on my laurels during these last 9 months or so, because for the first time in 9 years, I had an extended reprieve. And I think, and I'm reflecting, guys, I'm sorry. I know this is supposed to be me talking, but I'm just kind of reflecting while I'm up here too. I have not spent this time, I have not spent these 9 months being diligent. I have spent these 9 months just enjoying the reprieve, to be honest with you. Has there been work along the way? Absolutely. Have I moved forward in some things? Absolutely. Has God continued to do things for me that I could not do for myself? Yes. But in truth, a lot of what I've done is just enjoy the peace and quiet. Just enjoy that my phone's not going to ring and let me know that today is the day. Just enjoy a lot of what comes with having alcoholism and addiction in its active form removed from your life. I've not known that. My husband and I have not known that for the last, I would say, nine and a half years. So the reason I bring that up right now is I mentioned the strange mental blank spots. I was talking to my sponsor the other day, and I was sharing with her a conversation that I'd had with my daughter, and I said, doesn't matter how long I've done this. It doesn't matter, you know, what knowledge I have or any of the other things that go with it. There are times when I engage my loved one who is the addict, alcoholic, and everything I know and everything I believe and everything that I've practiced and everything that I encourage my sponsees to do, it's like gone. I'm just left with, I literally don't have words. And I stumble and I fumble and I try to figure out, okay, you know, I'm clicking off, what do I say, what do I say? So there's these long pauses. And that's humbling. And I think in this moment right here today, I'm thankful for that because it keeps me tethered to my sponsor. And it makes me remember that those words are so true, that my knowledge and my self-will are never going to get me where I need to be in this program. It's going to be y'all, the community, right? It says there's four things that you have to have a full program. To really be working a program, you have to do these things. You have to read literature. You have to have a sponsor. You have to be doing the steps. You have to be working with others. My sponsor reminds me it's not an 11-step program. It's a 12-step program. And the 12 steps says that we will practice these principles in all our affairs and that we will carry the message and that we will work with others. So when we stop at the 11th step, we've not completed the program. And so I have to read the literature. I have to get in it. And when I put it down for days or sometimes weeks at a time, that jacks with me. It really messes me up. That's why tonight I needed to have these things written down and I needed to say them out loud. I need to remain tethered to these ideas. Another thing in the big book, the Al-Anon program of action, though entirely sensible, is pretty drastic. It has meant that I've had to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That's page 42. several is an understatement. I've had to literally throw out almost everything and try and relearn a new way of life. I came into the program, as you guys already know, I was wounded, I was hurt, I was angry, I was resentful, I was bitter. I was a whole lot of things. None of them included happy, contented, or willing. I was not willing. And I can't even tell you guys now, just like I was so happy when Shannon shared how we first met. We've been friends for so long, I don't even remember. That was a great story to be like, oh, that's how we met. Now I remember. When I came in, I lost my train of thought. Where was I? Say it again. Yeah, I did. Thanks. That's awesome. You're so right. I did. Yeah, it says, our admission of personal powerlessness is the first step toward liberation, strength, happiness, and freedom. Again, I'm just quoting from the literature. Without the full and total acceptance of it, our well-being will be precarious and weak, if at all. So true. I didn't want to admit I was powerless over addiction. I was a single mom who had raised my daughter. Her father and I had gotten married. Again, one of my black sheep stories. I had gone away to college and was having a pretty darn good time. And during my time there, I had decided that I wanted to pursue a passion that I'd had in high school, which was dancing. So I was blessed enough to be able to dance for the university. And then one of the things that my mom had really wanted for me was to follow in her footsteps and be a part of the Greek system. So I got involved in sorority life, and that was a blast. Had great fun there. And through that, I had met a young man who played baseball for the university and was also in a fraternity. And we had a lot of fun in college. And wouldn't you know it, we go to New Orleans. We had the privilege. And I just want you to know it's an amazing privilege because I'm a Saints fan, if anybody knows, Don. And we got to dance at a Saints game. It was then called the Superdome. And we got to dance at a game in November, and that was amazing. And I think, I can't be for sure, but I think that's the night my daughter was conceived. So, you know, that's pretty close to Christmas time. So Christmas break rolls around, and I go with the man I'm dating to his home for the holidays. He was from Baton Rouge. He was a little Cajun. And we go, and we're having a good time, and then it's time for me to leave. I've got to go home and spend some time with my family. I have to go. So out of the blue, he shares with me. He said, Jay, I think you're pregnant. And I said, how dare you? Don't you dare say that to me. And he said, no, I really think you are. And I told him that he was nuts and that was crazy and don't ever say anything like that again. But it planted a seed. So when I went home, again, small town, you can get into the doctor like that. He was a family friend. My mom, so this tells you how much I did not think I was pregnant. I was like, hey, Mom, let's stop in at Doc so-and-so and, you know, I need a checkup. We go, and I'm pregnant. And so he says to me, we got to get rid of your mom. We need to talk about this. So I don't know what he did because I was in the room freaking out, but he got rid of my mom. And at that point, he could not be sure of how far along I was. He just knew that I was pregnant. So I leave there, and this was before cell phones and stuff, and a landline call, you know, those long-distance calls. I call my boyfriend, and I let him know, and he says, hey, that's not a problem. I'm 100% behind you. It's totally okay, not a problem. So I've got to get out of there because I feel like just looking at me, you can know that I'm pregnant, right? And the last thing. So Southern Baptist. We're nice. We're stoically nice. We show up nice. We present nice. We sound nice. We talk nice. And the last thing that a nice girl does is get pregnant. Okay? So I've got to get out of there. I'm scared to death of my dad. And I'm thinking, my dad knew everything, okay? Like everything. He just knew. And he knew everyone in the community. And this is not a lie. I'm sorry. I'm chasing a squirrel, but I got to tell you this. I would be at school. Something would go down because it always went down with me. And by the time I got home, my dad knew. I mean, hands down, my dad knew. Well, he used to work there. Most of the teachers and the administration were clients of his, and he was on the school board. I had the great honor of when I graduated, guess who gave me my diploma? I'm shaking hands in my grad picture with my dad. He gave me my diploma. So I'm thinking, oh, holy cow. So I get out of town. My boyfriend comes and gets me, and we go back, and we talk about it. And I call that brother of mine, that one, oh, my brother means so much to me. He is just, he's so precious to me. So I call my brother, Tim, and I say, hey, Tim, can you meet me? I got to tell you something. You're not going to believe it. So he meets me, and I tell him, and he, first thing he says is, okay, you're not telling Dad alone. You got to bring me with you. You're not telling Dad alone. And I said, no shit, I'm not telling Dad alone. So we go, and as was customary, in my dad's office, we always met with Dad in the office, okay? And he sat behind his desk, which was about twice the size of this, and he would sit in his seat, and we would sit in the seat where customers sat. And right behind my dad was a giant self-portrait of my dad at his desk like this. So you're looking at my dad. And my dad was an intimidating figure. So my brother and I show up, and, you know, my brother's a caretaker. And you know what? I was thinking about this today when I was having some quiet time. This is another side story, but it's important. You know why my brother is so precious to me? Because my brother fits my family narrative, and he was the golden child and is the golden child. I mean, my parents will tell you that hands down. And my teachers would have told you that, and fellow community members would have told you that. But while my brother fits in the family narrative, and it works for him, and that's good, because that's a personality that God gave him. My brother is the only member of the family who, while usually aghast at what I'm doing or how I'm showing up or behaving, he doesn't shame me for it. And he doesn't say, what the? Well, sometimes he does say, what the? Are you doing? But my brother just loves me. He just lets me be who I am. And I'm not sure, but every once in a while I have a sneaking suspicion. I think sometimes my brother wishes that he could just be free enough to do some of the things that I say and do. I really do. I don't have any proof for that, but I think it's true. So my brother and I show up, and my brother has been giving me the lowdown on how this is going to go down. He's totally choreographed it. And he's going to talk first. And then he's going to prep my dad that I have something to say, and then I'm going to chime in and just say it real fast, and then he's going to say some more stuff to my dad. So we do it just like my brother scripted it, and my dad, I still get like, a little nervous over that. My dad came up and over that desk and snatched my brother up and pulled him over the desk and said something to the effect of, where the hell were you? How long have you known? And how could you let this happen? And my brother's like, first of all, She lives away at school. I live here. B, I don't track her sex life, Dad. He really didn't say that. My brother would never say that to my dad. I think it was something like, she's away at school, Dad. I didn't know. The minute I knew, we decided to come tell you. My dad couldn't even look at me. So he continues to kind of ream out my brother. And then he gets up and he goes back into the storage area of his office space. And I see pictures and I kind of know some stuff that happened, but I have no idea what the conversation was. And then I just know that my brother and I leave and I go back to school. No, that's not true. I stayed the night. And because it was too late to go back, so I was going to go back the next morning. And my parents divorced when I was really young, and my stepmom comes up the stairs and tells me that my dad has shared with her what has happened, and that she's really sorry that that's happened, and that I just need to give my dad time. And that would look like about 2, maybe 3 months, my dad never spoke a word to me. He had nothing to do with me whatsoever. So I do know that I knew I didn't want to get married. And my brother had said, yeah, I don't think that's what you should tell Dad. And I said, no, I'm going to tell Dad. I'm not going to get married, and I'm going to figure it out. And going back, when I told my dad what had happened, I said, I'm pregnant and I'm getting married. And so that's what we did. I told you that my parents were divorced. And so anything that my dad did not want, my mom wanted, right? So my dad said, I will give you, it was a lot of money. I'm going to give you a lot of money. Just whatever you do, don't make a spectacle and get married in town. Please don't do that to me. Please do not bring your garbage into this community and parade it around like it's something to be celebrated. It's not. So my mom said, oh, this is a fantastic occasion for a beautiful wedding. And so she wanted to throw like the grand debutante New Orleans style wedding. I mean, it was going down. The only caveat was, I was not allowed to wear white, and I could not wear a full-length dress because that was saved for women who were actual virgins and had remained pure until their wedding day. So I had to wear an off-white dress, and it had to be T-length or shorter. That was my punishment. So we get married. I don't stay married very long. We stay married about 2.5 years. Up to the point that my dad, I don't know if you all guys know this, but a kind of Southern tradition is that during the pictures prior to a wedding, the dad puts the penny in the daughter's shoe. I don't know if everybody does that, but we did. And literally, my dad is putting the penny in my shoe in the picture, total fake smile, and telling me, you don't have to do, he had the money in his pocket. I have the money in my pocket. I am begging you not to walk down the aisle. Just stop. Just stop it. I didn't. I walked down the aisle. And that marriage didn't last. As I said, we lasted about 2.5 years. Totally my fault. Through no fault of my ex-husband's. It's not what I wanted to do, right? And I'm selfish and self-centered. And I want what I want when I want it. And I wasn't willing to accept responsibility for my actions, and I resented him. I resented him for, he graduated and he went on into his career, and I still had a couple of years of school left, and I wasn't going to be able to be a Derek doll, which was the biggest dream and goal in my life. I wanted to be a Derek doll. So we separated and moved apart. So I raised my daughter alone. Until I married about 11-ish years ago, maybe 12, but I think 11. So that was in the senior year of that was my daughter's senior year. And we would not be married very long before her disease would present itself. So throughout almost the entire time of my husband and I's marriage, my daughter's disease has been present. And it's greatly impacted our marriage. It's greatly impacted me. It impacted my career. I can't think of any area that it hasn't really impacted me. And with all that said, I think I was talking about step one. Step one, powerless over addiction. I could not admit that. I was a single mom. I couldn't imagine that I was powerless over my only child. I felt like there had to be something I could do. On days, I can still think that. I still think I might can find that magic bullet. There are days when I do think that. I could easily admit when I came in these rooms that I was unmanageable, but to admit that I was powerless was really hard for me. Again, I have to read a quote. "Who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one, of course. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It is truly awful to admit that no other kind of bankruptcy is like this one. Obsession with a loved one has now become the voracious creditor, bleeding us of all self-sufficiency and all will to resist its demands." That's from the 12 and 12. And that explains me completely when I came in here. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Again, the 12 and 12, I'm not going to read it to you, but the 12 and 12 talks about the one who comes into this program and who is really puffed up with their own knowledge and their own power. I thought I was self-sufficient. I thought I had been taught, and I thought that I could handle most situations. In a nice, stoic Southern Baptist family, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It doesn't matter if you don't have boots. You figure it out. So I came in here believing in a higher power, but thinking that I could do things beyond what any human being can do. I thought that being a mother was, I thought that meant I had special powers. I thought motherhood meant I had special powers, and I didn't. And being a mother does not give you the ability, no matter how great your maternal instinct, it's just not a match for the disease of alcoholism and addiction. And that was hard to accept. I was firmly convinced that it was something that I had done. I was firmly convinced that, like they say, that I had caused it. Therefore, I thought I could cure it. I thought I could control it. And it pissed me off when I found out that that's not true. That's not ever going to happen. Another thing that my sponsor tells me, and you guys have heard me say it over and over, and it's been a really bitter truth for me, is that I am never going to have enough finances. I'm never going to have enough emotional stability. I'm never going to have enough mentally, physically, emotionally to overcome my daughter's disease of addiction. First of all, it's not my disease. Second of all, it's not mine to overcome. And third of all, you know, being a mother doesn't cure cancer. It doesn't cure diabetes. It doesn't cure anything. Love doesn't cure anything. Love is just love. And this program has taught me that despite my daughter's disease and despite what she can do while in the grips of that disease, I can love my daughter. And I can love her well. And I can love her best through the guidance and the principles of this program. And I'm so thankful that my sponsor teaches me that, and that this program teaches me that. Step three. Let's talk about how that's impacted me. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I came in with a God of my own understanding. There are pieces and parts of that same God that I have today. A lot of that God I fired a couple of years ago into this program. I like the God that I know today much better. It's not the God of my dad. It's not the God of my mom. It's not the God of my early faith community, but it's my God. And I think he, she, it is pretty awesome. That's all I have to say about that. So because I do think he or she, it is pretty awesome, I'm more willing on most days to turn my will and my life over to him. I couldn't do that in the beginning. I can't turn my will and my life over to something that I don't trust and that I don't believe in. One of the things that I really wanted to do is I really wanted you guys to show me how to turn my daughter's will and her life over to God. And I wanted her God to be my God because my God was best. And I wanted him to relieve her, and I wanted him to take it all away, because my daughter's addiction and the disease and everything that that generated and created was causing my life to be unmanageable. I mean, like, in just frank terms, it was causing my life to be shit. And I really needed her to stop. Like, you're effing up my life, and I just don't have any more time or patience for that. I need you to stop it, right? I didn't realize that was selfish and self-centered. I didn't realize that wanting my daughter to appear and behave and act and to fit inside the script that I had written for her, I didn't realize that that was not loving. That was what love looked like to me. My parents loved me, but there was a script that was to be followed, right? And so, of course, that's how I had been loved, so that's how I loved. And it wasn't just my daughter. I think my husband can attest. He's had several scripts written for him. Some he reads like Shakespeare. Other he just goes, oh, this is not happening. We'll talk about that next time I talk. Making a searching and thorough inventory of ourselves. That's when I realized what I told you guys earlier. I realized that my daughter and I are two sides of the same coin because of my fourth and fifth step. I realized that I do exactly what my daughter does to get the drink or the drug. I do to stop her. We may sit in this club on two sides of a divider and say this room and that room. I think that we're the same. I think we have the same isms. I think in the original literature, I was referred to as a co-alcoholic. I engage in the same mental obsessions, the same behaviors that my daughter does. I would not have seen that without a fourth step. My fifth step, admitted to ourselves, to God, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. The big one for me in that one is I can admit to God all day long because God's silent. He does not necessarily use an audible voice to talk back to me. That's perfect because that just leaves me to rationalize and justify all day long. And then what happens is I end up signing God's name to my bullshit. Like, he's just like, oh yeah, he just co-signs my crap all day, because I'll say, well, you know, I was alone with the Lord and he told me. But when I say that stuff out loud to my sponsor, she doesn't co-sign quite as frequently or as often as God does when it's just me. She's much more likely to say, you know, let's think about that for a minute. Let's double check our motives. Let's think about what we're doing. So sitting as a sponsee with a sponsor is super powerful, but sitting as a sponsor with a sponsee, that makes this program come full circle. That is magic, is sitting and listening to someone else. And that's what I love about the fifth step. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. Entirely is a tough word for me. I'm not necessarily always ready to have God remove my defects of character. I think in one of our pieces of literature, it talks about that we can covet our defects. We think that they're like old slippers that are like really soft and comfortable that we want to stay in. I can do that sometimes. And so I'm thankful that my sponsor helps me to look at my character defects and step out of them. She helps me to become entirely ready. Again, that's the power of this program. I'm never going to do that on my own. But I can come to meetings and get inspired to step out. I can listen to my sponsor and get inspired to step out. Step seven, Emily asked him to remove our shortcomings. That I want what I want when I want it is a big one for me. I want my character defects removed when I want them removed. And I want them removed how I want them removed. And that's not how God works. And so this program has allowed me to become more comfortable with that. But that's still one that I fight. Step eight, made a list of all people we had harmed. What I can say about that is my sponsor allowed me the privilege of having three columns. One that says yes, one that says no, and one that says hell no, I am never making an amends on that. And the amazing thing about that is that freedom has made it possible that as to date, those that were in my hell no, that's never happening column have all drifted over to the maybe or the yes. And I've been able to do that. And I'm thankful for that. Step nine, made direct amends. I think the thing that has helped me most about that is remembering that the amends that I make to people, most of mine are living amends, number one. Number two, the amends process is not a process for me to justify or rationalize my behavior. The amends process is simply for me, in my understanding and what I'm taught, is that it's just simply a time to say, hey, I did this. I did this. May or may not ask someone to forgive me or say I'm sorry, because my sponsor teaches me that that's having an expectation and that's asking someone to give me something that's not mine to ask for. It's not mine to ask for someone to forgive me. They may or may not. I just have to own my stuff. Continue to take personal inventory. My sponsor does that with me, teaching me to do that through the third step prayer. I love the third step prayer, talking about relieving me of the bondage of self and looking over my day and trying to determine how was I as a wife? How was I as a sponsee? How was I as a friend? How did I show up that day? And could I have done it better? Step 11, always seeking through prayer and meditation. One of the things I've learned is that I don't limit my conscious contact to any specific act or prayer. I try to stay in conscious contact with God all day in a variety of ways. That may look like taking a walk. That may be spending time with my husband. A lot of different ways to do that. And having a spiritual awakening. So thankful for that. Paul Ornstein is a Holocaust survivor, and this is my close. Paul Ornstein was a Holocaust survivor. He was also a really good friend of Bill W.'s, and he worked closely with Bill W. as Bill worked to craft the 12 steps and the program that we know and exists today. And one of the things that Paul Ornstein says is that the self is always searching for the right environment to complete itself. And for me, Al-Anon is that environment. Al-Anon has allowed me to complete myself, and you guys are a big part of that, and I thank you so much, and I thank you for your patience. I ran a couple minutes over. Thank you so much. This is a privilege and an honor, and I appreciate you letting me ramble on and work some things out from up here. Thanks.